This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
I like to sit in a chair sometimes, but I'm sitting in a chair tonight because I hurt my back stage diving at a Buddhist meditation retreat. Not that many people can say that.
I saw it.
I hurt my back stage diving at a retreat. So if you miss the retreat, make sure to come next year. It's more fun than just sitting around. What I wanted to talk about tonight was the process of awakening and the process of gaining insight and liberation, and what Jack Kornfield called the process of spiritually maturing. And I think that that's a nice way to think about our meditation practice and about the process, that it's a process of maturing, and that it's not, my father talked about the gradual awakening. And that for most of us, that's what it is. It's the months and years of practice that slowly, slowly we mature. Slowly, slowly, we gradually have more happiness, less suffering, more, we become more generous, less selfish, more kind, less unkind. In Kornfield's book, A Path with Heart, towards the end of the book, I just flipped it open recently. I haven't read it for many, many years, although it's a great book, and I encourage you to read it. Jack Kornfield, A Path with Heart. I think it's one of the kind of core texts for our Western Vipassana insight Theravadan Buddhism tradition. Path with Heart. Towards the end of the book, he gives a list of 10 signs of spiritual maturity. 10 of the qualities that come when our practice develops and matures, and as we continue on this path, and some of the things to look forward to. And I think it's quite a good list for us to discuss tonight and to look a little bit of, like, well, where am I at with this? Not to judge yourself and say, I have none of those qualities. But to just something, a healthy goal, a healthy kind of map of, this is where I want to head. And it's interesting that actually what he starts with, the first sign of spiritual maturity, is a relinquishing of idealism and perfectionism. And that often we start a spiritual path with this, like, I'm going to be fully enlightened and I'm going to be perfect. And meditation means you don't think at all. This idealistic, I'm going to finally stop my mind because my mind is my enemy. I will meditate. I will completely shut that shit down. Or I will have no desire. I'll have no, I'm going to just be a love zombie. No opinions. This idealistic, delusional idea about what it means to be committed to a spiritual path. You know that one? Where you come and you're very idealistic and really this idea about perfection. And we see the Buddha statues. We don't have any visible right here, but it's like I have to sit like a Buddha and be complete, like a statue, like a piece of metal. I have to be perfectly still and perfect posture. And that part of the maturity that comes is less idealism and less perfectionism and more openness to bad posture and more openness to being with what's happening in the mind rather than getting rid of the mind. Being with the aging process of the body rather than this kind of like delusion of, like, I will get enlightened and be forever young. It's a fountain of youth's pyramid scheme or something. Some teachers, because we can get so hooked into the perfectionism and the idealism, they'll, in some schools of Buddhism, they say, like, just forget about enlightenment. Forget about it. Just work on being kind. Forget about the perfection of becoming an arahant or a Buddha. Just work on being generous. You don't have to be perfect. Don't go for the perfect enlightenment. My father would say that maybe rather than getting so attached to your enlightenment, just have a goal of lightening up. Just how about a little bit lighter rather than perfectly enlightened? How about, recovery people, how about progress rather than perfection? Really just going for that rather than I'm going to be the ideal, perfect, unattainable bodhisattva. I will never think about myself again, ever. I will only care for all sentient beings. Good luck. The second factor, sign of spiritual maturity, is kindness. And that natural kind of kindness that comes where it's not so... I know for myself, kindness did not come naturally to me. When I began practicing, I was very selfish. I was very afraid and just... I was a mess. And kindness was seen as like weakness and seen as... it was not a desirable thing or something that I had much familiarity with. I felt genuine kindness. And that through doing the loving kindness practices and therapy and steps and years of practice, eventually getting the experience of actually being kind, not fake nice, not the fake it till you make it, but genuinely caring about myself and others, that it comes with time. When we make it a priority, when we open to it, kindness is a sign of your heading in the right direction. I'm always so suspect of Buddhists who don't appear to be very kind. And there is that kind of school of Buddhism that's like very detached and very separate from and very kind of stoic. You meet some of those Buddhists, you know, and they're just like, is there anybody in there? Are you a nice person? Are you kind? I get that you have on this mask about you don't have any emotions. You're totally peaceful or something, but it's just not inspired to me. When I see someone like the Dalai Lama and he's like just sitting there giggling, and you can just, like, the kindness is radiating, you just know that, like, this is a nice guy. Not a fake nice guy, but like a genuinely kind, caring, compassionate. That's inspiring. That's maturity to me. I don't know. I think that some of it is cornfield and my preference or whatever. In Burma, some of the monastics, who you know are these like incredibly evolved and mature nuns and monks, but it's part of their practice to not let their personality kind of come into their teaching, so you won't get a lot of warmth or kindness from them. Actually, some of the Burmese, when they're teaching, will teach from behind a fan. They don't even want you to see their face while they're teaching you the Dharma, because they don't want you to mistake their personality for this deep truth. But you won't get much kindness often from some of those guys. I'm suspect of that, personally. The third factor of spiritual maturity is patience. And again, you can't really fake patience. But you know it when it's there. When you're okay with waiting. When you're okay with things unfolding the way they're unfolding rather than what you had hoped or what you want, or actually being at ease with the process, patient with the process. I heard one teacher say that sometimes we will use the term like waiting patiently. I just said, you know, waiting. But he said, he thought you're either waiting or you're practicing patience. But that actually waiting is impatient on some level. And that patience is just being at ease with what is. This is what's happening now. I'm standing here in line. Or I'm meditating again and my mind is completely distracted and I was hoping that 15 years into this shit, I would be more concentrated and being patient with that process. I'm like, okay, this is what's happening now. The fourth quality of spiritual maturity that Cornfield talks about is a sense of immediacy, an understanding that what's really important is here now. That our happiness or our unhappiness is here now. That it's not about the future, it's not about the past. This immediacy of living moment to moment with what is. In the here, in the now. That it's not about what's happening, it's about how we're responding to what's happening in the present. The fifth quality of spiritual maturity, Cornfield talks about an integrated personal practice. That our mindfulness, our kindness, our compassion, our generosity becomes very much integrated into who we are. And it's not just like what we do on retreat or what we do when we go to class, or but actually you're taking it to work with you and on the freeway. And on the subway or on the whatever you're doing at school, that it's an integrated way of life, that it is very personal way of being and not a separate when I'm doing yoga, when I'm at a meeting, when I'm meditating, but it becomes very much a way of being, very personal to who you are, how you talk, how you listen. The sixth quality of maturity is questioning. And maybe a healthy sense of skepticism. But a willingness to truly question our teachers, our traditions, our own belief systems. Why am I so convinced of this or that? Where does this belief come from? Is what my teachers are telling me, is what the Buddha is teaching, does it completely resonate? Does it really make sense? Why doesn't it really, why does it? This ability to question. So sometimes in our early practices, we're just so inspired or so desperate that we're just like, okay, I'll just believe it. Just tell me what to do. My way doesn't work. The Buddha enlightened, cool, tell me what to do. No questioning, no discernment, just blind hope. And which can be a good thing in the beginning, but as our practice develops, it becomes more and more clear that it's not about believing, it's about experiencing. It's about knowing, verified faith, not blind faith, and questioning is a part of that process. Questioning traditions, questioning teachers, questioning philosophies. And maybe most important is questioning our own views and opinions. It's so easy to get stuck in this conditioned process and not even know why we don't believe in reincarnation. Why don't you believe in reincarnation? Well, I just don't. Question your beliefs. Why do you believe in reincarnation? Well, Buddha said it was true. Question that. The seventh factor is flexibility. Not being so rigid. Talked about one of the things that happens in the process of awakening. The Buddha talked about not being attached to rites and rituals, even of your own spiritual practice or your own religious commitments. That the rigidity around, I meditate every single morning at 7 a.m. no matter what, leaves. Maybe you still meditate at 7 a.m. every morning. But the rigidity around it changes. And if something happens and, you know, it's actually not happening that day, it's okay to meditate at 8 a.m. There's a flexibility around your rituals and your practices and your time and energy. That's a huge one, flexibility. Being okay, part of it is being okay with change. Becoming more and more okay with things don't always work out the way we plan them. Or even rarely work out the way we plan them. Being really flexible about there's this saying that Ajahn Sumedho, he's a monk in the Thai forest tradition, that a whole bunch of people around here have taken to getting tattooed on them. And it says, right now it's like this. And using that sort of as a mantra throughout our lives, right now it's like this. And my plan was for it to be completely different than this right now. I had this whole other idea about what right now was supposed to be like, but what it is like is this. This emotion, this thought, this sound, this smell, whatever it is what's happening right now, and the flexibility of being with what is, the immediacy, here and now, this is what's happening. And I can suffer about it, because it's not how it's supposed to be. This was not my plan. Or I can accept it, I can be flexible and say, well, right now, this is the way it is. Not really worth suffering about. Have you become a little bit more flexible in your since you've been meditating? The eighth factor of spiritual maturity, according to Jack Kornfield, is the ability and process of embracing opposites. Sometimes our thinking can be so black and white and so all or none, and it either has to be completely this way or completely this way. And that part of our process of awakening, maybe the most obvious embracing of opposites comes when we accept that life is a mixture of joy and sorrow. And that it is completely and totally impossible to create a life that is only joy and no sorrow. Even for a fully enlightened being, I believe that sorrow continues, and that part of our process is embracing that there is joy and sorrow in life, and not suffering about hating the sorrow and being addicted to the joy, but embracing that this is the way it is. Some moments are pleasant, some are unpleasant. Our well-being does not need pleasure all the time. Doesn't need all of the pain to go away. We don't have to stop death and grief in order to be happy. We just have to stop hating death and grief and embrace that it's part of the process. Make sense? Embracing opposites, and it's so difficult. It's really a challenging part of our practice for most of us. The ninth sign of spiritual maturity is seen in our relationships. That our practice of wisdom, of compassion, of kindness, of generosity, of loving kindness, forgiveness, the wisdom that comes from practicing the Dharma is a relational wisdom. And it's about how we treat each other. It's about how we treat our partners and our children and our parents. And it's about how we treat the people that we don't know when we're walking down the street. It's how we treat each other in traffic. I think that part of Cornfield's piece here too is a little bit maybe householder, for Buddhists, a little householder-centric. Jack had been a monk and been celibate, and that sort of non-intimate relationship spiritual discipline. And I think that part of saying that a sign of spiritual maturity is the willingness to be in relationships, knowing how difficult it is to be in sexual, intimate, committed relationships, and taking that on as a practice, not avoiding it. Perhaps it's actually easier to be celibate if you don't want to suffer. Perhaps it's easier to avoid intimate relationships if you don't want to deal with difficulties. Now, celibacy is its own difficulty, for sure. No doubt. That is a difficulty too, for sure. But it's a viable option. And I believe that part of, or I'm assigning the meaning anyways, that part of what's being said here is that entering into relationship is a high form of practice and takes some serious maturity. The ability to love and connect and accept and forgive without attachment, without clinging to our partners, without trying to control our partners. You have to be kind and patient and integrated and flexible and being able to embrace the opposites in the relationship to be able to be in those intimate relationships without being miserable about not getting your way, about what kind of mood he's in today, or what kind of inflexibility she's showing up as. Relationships as part of our practice. And long-term, healthy, and it doesn't have to be long-term relate. I mean, I wouldn't, I don't have any judgments of, you know, also we're in impermanence. So relationships also end. That's part of the process. That's part of the flexibility. That's part of the understanding. The last thing that Cornfield put on this list, and I really appreciate it. The last sign of spiritual maturity is ordinariness. That there's not something special or rarefied, or that actually when we really are in being mindful, it's very ordinary. We're really coming from a place of kindness and flexibility, and we're in relationships, and we're not special. It's actually really ordinary. Many years ago, and this is, I don't know if this is the best example or not, but I'll give it. I took some friends of mine who were very new to practice, and this is 1996. Six or seven or something like that. And I took them to Spirit Rock Meditation Center up in Marin, and there was this benefit for Ram Dass. So it was Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Lama Surya Das, and my parents, Stephen and Andrea Levine, were there, and Ram Dass was there, and I forget what other teachers, Wes Nisker, like all of the kind of Western Buddhist Vipassana, everybody, all of the teachers were there. And, you know, they're all kind of in T-shirts, basically. T-shirts and jeans, or, you know, some of Cornfield likes to wear his, like, Indian little vest. A couple of them have a, you know, a little bit of hippie fashion. But mostly they're, you know, pretty kind of like T-shirt. It's kind of a T-shirt crowd, or maybe a button-up, but it's a pretty casual. And very kind of ordinary street clothes is part of the point. And then there's one guy there who's got like robes. There was some other monks there, but there's this one guy who's got robes, and he's got like one of those Hindu tridents, like one of those big staffs, like a trident, and dreadlocks all wrapped up. And, you know, it looks like he's like right out off the Ganges, but he's a white dude. And he and this guy actually, I'm not going to name him because it's being recorded. I might get back to him. But anyways, this guy has been practicing for a really long time and has been around that scene, the Buddhist Hindu scene, for since the 60s, for a really long time. But and he really looks, he looks like a sadhu. He looks like one of those Indian, you know, he's... Everyone else, super ordinary looking, but this guy looks spiritual. Really looks spiritual. And he's just back from like a 20-year crack run. Seriously. Like left the Dharma, like been out smoking crack and, you know, chaining prostitutes to radiators, and just like in this like insanity, used car salesman, like just total, but he's got the dreads and the robes and the Shiva's trident. And my friend is like, that guy is spiritual. I can tell by looking at that guy that he, like, what's he into? Like, oh, can I, like, I want to become his disciple. Like, well, you know, he's a newcomer, basically. The guy is just back from years of suffering, of creating suffering for himself. And, you know, he's come back to the Dharma, and, you know, he really had this detour, like, two-decade detour, and has, like, now come back and is doing well. And I don't know if that's really the best example, but there's Cornfield, there's Stephen Levine, there's Sharon Salzberg, there's these people who have been completely committed to their practice for all of these decades, looking totally ordinary. Not dressed the part, not trying to look or act spiritual, but just being ordinarily kind and generous and flexible and integrated in their relationships. I don't mean to diss people who wear robes. There's something wonderful about people who wear robes. But wearing robes is not a sign of spiritual maturity, no matter how long you've been wearing them. I think that that's very, very important for us to understand and see, that sometimes in our immaturity we project, oh, like, she's in robes, he's in robes, they must be really a good person. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Maybe. There are, you know, some of my favorite teachers wear robes. But they're very ordinary too. They're not very precious about their robes or, you know, whatever they're wearing. They're very ordinary, very accessible, very kind most of the time. Non-idealism, kindness, patience, and immediacy to our practice, here, now, integrated into our lives, personal, questioning. Healthy skepticism, flexible, not attached to things being the way we thought they were going to be. The embracing of opposites. Relationships. And ordinariness. And some of the qualities to strive for and to develop, and some of the kind of mile markers that you will notice in yourself as you continue your practice. And you will see that this becomes more and more ordinary, more and more integrated, more and more relational, more and more flexible, and so forth. So these are some of my thoughts about spiritual maturity, the process of awakening, and, you know, connected with that first question from Asher about how is this a blessing to others? And it becomes more obvious when we talk about this list, right? If you're a flexible, kind, patient, integrated person, you will be appreciated during the holidays by your family. You will really be a blessing. Because it's our lack of these qualities that make us a pain in the ass and make us part of the problem and make us part of creating suffering in our families and in our communities and on the streets. And when we end suffering, we are a benefit to all living beings. time for questions, comments, clarifications, deeper investigation of any of these, please.
Can you talk more about ordinariness? I mean, if somebody who embraces fashion or who enjoys wearing a suit excluded from being spiritual or less spiritual?
No, I think that's why I think it was sort of a bad, you know, using the fashion example, I think was a little, not really the best. I think that ordinariness means if your, whatever fashion choice you have, if it's suit and tie, ordinary, you know, but you're that's what you, how you live, and you have all of these other qualities of kindness and patience, and that it doesn't matter what you're wearing at all. Nobody is excluded. But I think that there's less need to be seen as spiritual. As the more spiritual you become, there's less and less need to be identified with the garb. Chogyam Trungpa in the 70s, all the hippies were coming to him to study Buddhism, and they were, you know, wearing the Indian clothes and whatever, the long hair and dirty fingernails or whatever they were, however they were, and he actually put them all in suits. He said, you know, the cultural norm, like, cut your hair, wear a suit, be an ordinary American. That was his thing. You know, kind of, or not even, like, be a conservative. Don't be a freaky hippie. Like, do what you resist was part of his thing. I would not, you know, if they made me wear a suit, I don't know if I would have lasted, personally. But it was a good discipline for many people. Now, I think as the ordinariness has nothing to do with fashion. I know for myself, there was a period in my early practice where, you know, I wanted to wear the t-shirts with Buddhas on them and wanted to kind of, then I just started making my own Dharma punk stuff or whatever, but I wanted to wear some Indian clothes or, you see it a lot, sometimes you see it even like people who are studying with Asian teachers. You ever seen a white guy speaking in broken English? Because his Tibetan teacher speaks like that. This sort of emulation of like, I want to be like my teacher so bad that I'm wearing the Tibetan colors or the Zen colors or the Theravadan colors. Or... And I think that as maturity comes, that often goes away. And it's like, actually what I really like are suits. Right? Or t-shirts. Or... And for some people, they say, actually, what I really like is maroon. I really like the Tibetan colors, and that becomes genuine for some people and ordinary for some people. May any goodness that comes from our practice and discussion of the Buddha's Dharma be shared outward in all directions with all living beings. May each one of us do what needs to be done to mature spiritually, and may we share these blessings with all beings everywhere. See you soon.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.